tonight on Arena. For the days that's in it, the folklore associated with May Day, and new albums from BC Camplight, Jonah's Policewoman and Ghostport up for review. +51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Today is May Day, and in spite of the terrible virus that's limiting our lives so much, the weather has at least the hint of May about it, suggesting the coming of summer. May Day is an ancient festival stretching back to Roman times, and in Ireland, its tradition date back to pagan times. So, to celebrate the day that's in it, I'm joined by Monica Gale from the Classics Department of Trinity College and by Patricia Lysett of UCD, who's an expert on all things folkloric in Ireland. I'll start with you, Monica, and the Romans. I suppose May Day really came at the end of a party time more than anything else. The Feast of Flora ran from April through until the beginning of May. So is May really in the Roman times marking the end of something rather than the beginning of something?
Yeah, yes, you could say that, John. May, in fact, was a rather solemn month in the Roman calendar. The main festival, if that's the right word, was a sort of day of the dead, the Lemuria, when evil spirits, or the spirits of the dead, the malicious spirits of the dead, mingled with the living and had to be propitiated. But April, in contrast, was a rather cheery month with a whole series of festivals, of which the last was the Feast of Flora, as you mentioned.
So, in fact, we're looking more in Roman times, or in Roman culture. We're looking at a kind of October-November feel that, where we would be celebrating and looking at, you know, the other side and remembering the souls of the dead.
I suppose you could say that, but a Flora's festival was very much a spring festival. The Romans were, although, you know, by the first century BC and later, the city of Rome had grown to a world, the capital of a world empire, they were still very much a people that thought of themselves as agricultural, that remembered their agricultural roots. And of course, this time of year, you know, plants are coming into bud and into flower, and that's a very sort of precarious time, I suppose, in the agricultural calendar. So it was very important to, well, I suppose, both to celebrate spring and the festival of Flora, but also to propitiate her, to keep her on side, to ensure that the harvest would be a good one in the autumn.
And did flowers actually play a big part in Roman celebrations or in Roman traditions?
They did. I mean, flowers were very strongly associated with parties in general. So it was traditional in Roman culture, for example, at a dinner party or a drinking party, to wear garlands of flowers. But the festival itself, I mean, our main source here is the poet Ovid, who was writing towards the end of the first century BC. And he actually depicts himself as conversing with the goddess. It's rather a kind of fantasy setting. But she emphasizes the fact that she's not just the goddess of flowers, that she's the patroness of crops as well and flowering plants. So it's a sort of very cheery festival associated with parties and with drinking, but it also has this kind of agricultural side to it, very much a link to fertility. And in fact, I'd be quite interested to hear whether that's true of modern Irish customs as well, whether this link with fertility and with the growth of crops still persists in modern times.
Well, let me go to Patricia Lysett then, who will be able to answer precisely that question. But before that, I suppose flowers and the beginning of May, the gardens are beginning to bloom, hopefully, at this point in time. Patricia, did flowers play a big part, and have they played a big part in the May tradition in Irish folklore in the past?
Well, they definitely have. Flowers were involved with the May celebration throughout the whole island of Ireland. In fact, the May celebration in Ireland was very joyful. It was a real celebration of nature, of the renewal of nature, of the trees and leaf, and the fresh grass for the cows, and of course the flowers. And these were the wild flowers, usually yellow, like the primrose, the buttercup, the cowslip, the marigolds, and so on. And there are wonderful accounts of children, but also older people going out actually and picking these flowers and bringing them home, either in a celebratory fashion, bringing hugomerfane and saurelin, for example. We brought home the summer with us. And then bringing them to the house and putting them in various places around the house. But the other side of that was that there was a certain, it was also somber to some extent, because as Monica has stressed there, again, there was an agricultural element to it. and it was a time of the year when you were concentrating on milk production and on butter. So there's a link between the yellow flowers, if you like, and the produce that is produced at that time of year. But they brought them home, they put them on the doorstep, they put them on the threshold, on the windowsills, on the roofs of the cow byre, and so on. They also placed them around wells because wells, of course, people felt that others could go to the wells on May morning and perhaps take the top of the well and in some way affect your dairy produce for the coming year. So the flowers were definitely celebratory and they were definitely decorative, but they were also very much protective in relation to the very important food product and commercial product of season, that's milk and butter.
Yeah, and of course, in the Irish language and in many places, May Day is often referred to as Lá Buí Bealtaine, literally Yellow May Day. So
exactly. And some of the flowers, for example, the marigold is Lá Buí Bealtaine. So and the other one is Comanima, the buttercup. They're lovely names, but you have the yellow colour and you have the indirect reference, if you like, to the product of that time, which is the butter.
And I don't know if we think about our nearest neighbours in the UK and their maypole, I suppose the flowers do play a part in that, but they seem quite innocent, quite charming. That seems miles away from the Roman take that you've been describing to us, Monica.
Yes, absolutely. So Ovid, for example, has the poet writes about the goddess Flora, that she's not gloomy, she's not high-flown. She wants her rights to be open to the common man and warns us to use life's beauty while it's in bloom. The thorn is spurned when the rose has fallen. So I think that there are two points there. One is that it was perceived as a rather sort of lower-class festival, a bit of a celebration for the ordinary person in the Roman world, but also that it was very much a rather bawdy sort of festival, very much a festival associated with fertility and with sexuality. So it was a festival, according to Ovid, again, particularly celebrated by sex workers, a million miles, as you say, from our image, perhaps, of innocent May queens and all dressed in white and so on. For the Romans, it was very much a festival associated with drunkenness, with bright colours. Ovid says that bright colours were traditionally worn. I think of it perhaps as being a little bit like Paddy's Day in Dublin in a more normal year than the present year. So lots of sort of drunken people revelling around. But perhaps the most surprising aspect to the modern way of thinking, something that we certainly wouldn't associate with religious festivals, is that there were theatre performances and also chariot racing and the circus took place traditionally as part of the festival. But the theatre performances particularly seem to have involved an element of a kind of striptease. So actresses stood up on stage and disrobed themselves, as Ovid puts it. And presumably this is connected with the fertility element. But as I said, it seems very, very sort of surprising, I think, to a modern reader, a modern audience, not at all what we would associate with religious ritual.
Of course, and taking up on that theatrical side of things, if I could, in the Irish situation, Patricia, you have, I suppose, in Christian times, you have the May altar and the carrying often of the statue of the Blessed Virgin Mary through a housing estate or through a part of a town to be placed in the altar and flowers placed around the altar. Is there anything in pre-Christian times that heralds what was then done in the Christian era?
Well, apart from, as I've mentioned about bringing the flowers in, but I think the May altar enables one to actually bring types of flowers and branches into the house that maybe you wouldn't have done before, like the whitethorn and so on. And this this May altar, I think, is really very interesting because if you look around in Dublin city and suburbs, you find all these Marian altars and statues, and they are already, a number of them I've seen have already flowers left with them, associated with them at this time of the year. So it's picking up on the flower element that was there before, and it's actually bringing it into house and making part of religious harmony. And of course, this was very much cherished by children. And also, we think perhaps of the May customs and so on as being ultimately associated with children. And I suppose they're coming more and more like that. But formerly they were very much an adult performance, and this performance involved quite robust celebration, like dancing and, I presume, imbibing and so on, and having, as was in Dublin City, where you had the great Maybushes at either side of the Liffey. And, of course, Maytime is a transition time. It is a movement from one season to the other. It's a sort of time out of time. It's a very tense. I think this comes out very much in what we know about these great these great Maybushes that you had, one in Smithfield and Coombe and the Liberties and so on, and the lighting of fires and the raiding of the Maybush and stealing of the Maybush. This element of contest in the May Festival, and of course what's behind that is whoever wins has the look for the year. So it was serious and it was very celebratory, and it was very festive at the same time. Sides of the coin.
Yeah, great local rivalries about
exactly,
who had the
great
best.
Local rivalry. And the point about it was that because you had the Maybush and all the associated activities that went on around it by the community, because they all contributed to it, these were times when actually that sort of rivalry was expected, and it was in a way regulated, and everyone sort of were the best of friends afterwards.
Well, and any local rivalries in the Roman situation, or were they all too loyal to the empire to start talking about small local rows?
Monica? I suppose in the context of the festival, the rivalries would have organised themselves more around the chariot races than competitions amongst the local inhabitants themselves. So chariot racing was the kind of ancient equivalent of football, but there were four teams, and they each had their really passionate supporters, to the extent that, you know, fights might break out between the supporters of rival teams. And we do know Ovid again tells us that chariot racing took place as part of the celebrations of the Feast of Flora.
All right. Well, listen, you've given us a great taste of what we might be able to do some May in the future, get out and celebrate in the fashion that you speak about. I think whatever celebrations will be happening today, a little bit more muted, perhaps. And that was Patricia Lycett of UCD and Monica Gale from the Classics Department of Trinity College talking to us about some of the folklore activities associated with May. And in the midst of all of that, Patricia mentioned this song.
So a scoch nook is she scoch clown Callini mashach a bon gala glegal Hogmer fain and sauveling
Hogmer fain and Sara Ling, the voice of Éire Leonard there and his pals in the gloaming with that lovely version of that song, bringing us to almost 17 and a half minutes past seven on Friday night's Arena. And time for a quick announcement, a note of congratulations, in fact. On Wednesday's programme, we interviewed the writer and poet Dermot Bulger in advance of Poetry Day Ireland, which was celebrated yesterday. And another big event in the poetry calendar took place yesterday as well, the announcement of the annual Moth Magazine Poetry Prize, which Dermot mentioned to us, worth €10,000 to the winner. Professor of Poetry at Yale University, Claudine Rankin, was given the task of choosing between the four shortlisted poems, and her choice is now available to read on the website of the Moth magazine. So we on Arena are delighted to send our congratulations to Damon O'Brien from Australia for his submission, which was entitled The Knave. The poem was praised for its wonderful command of line and imagery that both seduces and disturbs instantaneously. As I said, you can read the poem in full on the website of the Moth magazine, that is themothmagazine.com, and on the same website you can get the current issue of The Moth, where all four shortlisted poems have been printed. In 2016, after 20 years of writing, the Kentucky-born author Garth Greenwell was catapulted to the kind of international acclaim most artists can only ever dream of, and that was for his debut novel, What Belongs to You. His second work of fiction, Cleanness, might be a novel or a set of linked short stories. Greenwell himself calls it a song cycle. Either way, it returns us to Sofia, a Bulgarian city the author knows well, and to the unnamed narrator, an American teacher of his previous book. And Garth Greenwell joins me on the line now from Iowa. There is that old joke, of course, Garth, that, you know, it takes years to become an overnight success. How big a surprise for you was it, the reaction to What Belongs to You, which was phenomenally successful?
Oh, it was the biggest surprise of my life. You know, I don't think anyone expected the book to get any attention at all. So, you know, the fact that it did was really a source of wonder for me.
Have you worked out in your mind? Do you think you know what it was about the book that attracted people so much?
No, you know, I mean, anyone who watches the world of books or who cares about any of the arts knows that, you know, the question of success has very little to do with the things we really value in art. I think a lot of it has to do with luck. I feel immensely grateful that the book found a much bigger audience than I ever dreamed for it.
And I my understanding is that as you were writing the debut novel, What Belongs to You, there were aspects of the narrator, same narrator in the new book, Cleanness, there were aspects of his experience or aspects of his story that you were writing on the side that you knew weren't going to enter the debut novel, but that might become something else.
Yeah, that's right. You know, that first book is about an obsessive relationship. And one of the things I understood about it very early on was that the book itself needed to be obsessively focused on the two people at its heart, and that it had to exclude a lot of the world, the rest of the world. And that was bearable to me because I knew there would be this other container for that could be more varied and more mobile and see more things in the world.
And how completed then was Cleanness, or how near completion was it when the success of What Belongs to You started to kick in?
You know, I think I probably had maybe 4 of the 9 chapters, and I feel very grateful to that. I mean, you know, writing for me is an experience of privacy and inwardness. And, you know, I mean, to me, you know, writing is an experience of failing every day. You know, I think to be an artist means, you know, you have to confront failure every day. And for that, I need privacy. And the publicity of What Belongs to You was destabilizing. You know, it took me a long time to find my way back to that private space that I write from. And I was grateful that the project, you know, already had an existence. And so when I was able to get back, it was there waiting.
And I suppose in some ways it took the hex off of the success. Wasn't quite as maybe as much of a distraction when it came to writing the rest of the stories in Cleanness. Let's get a sense of where a narrator is at. As you say, there was that obsessive relationship in the debut novel. The narrator is in a different place now, and certainly as we meet him at the beginning of this, he's as you give that chapter title, that first chapter title, Mentor. He's a mentor to lots of the young people he's teaching.
That's right. You know, when I think about the book as a whole, I think it's a book about intimacy and about various intimacies that have shaped this narrator's life and challenged his sense of himself. And I think one of, you know, his profoundest experiences of meaningful relationships with other people is his experiences with his students. I mean, that was certainly my, you know, the big surprise for me when I taught high school, which I did for 7 years before becoming a writer. The big surprise to me was how much I loved my students. You know, I was sort of knocked sideways to discover a kind of love I didn't know that I had been capable of, which is a kind of disinterested love, what I imagined to be, I'm not a parent, but what I imagined to be a kind of parental love. It was a profound experience and a transformative one, and it is for my narrator too.
Yeah, and essentially that first chapter, we find the narrator in the company of his young student, and the young student is coming to terms with his own sexuality. He's remembering a friendship he had, in fact, a very close friendship, but it turns out that the friendship was, in fact, a sexual attraction between the young student and his very best friend. There's a heartbreaking line in the midst of all of that where the young boy who's telling his story to the teacher says, "I hardly fantasized about anything. I didn't want that part of me to exist." He's obviously speaking about fantasizing there about his friend in a sexual fashion. He didn't want that part of himself to exist. That's heartbreaking.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that's an experience that lots of lesbian and gay people have. And, you know, the discovery of that desire, which very often happens through this kind of close friendship, can be a very difficult discovery. And I wanted in that the opening of the book, you know, it's a story about first love, and it's this, you know, a student who's experiencing his first heartbreak. And of course, when you're in the midst of that, you know, it feels like the end of the world. You know, there's no way to have any perspective on that experience. And the narrator, of course, being older, you know, he knows that the student will get through this, that, you know, this isn't the only possible love for him, which the student believes. I wanted in the story to take seriously that experience of first love, which, you know, from the outside can seem, I don't know, a kind of delusion or a dream or, you know, something not entirely serious. But of course, when you're inside it, it's the most serious thing in the world, and it marks the rest of our lives.
And if that life and that, or that line rather, that I read out, and that emotional punch that it gave me, if that lulled me into a false sense of security or a false sense of what was in front of me. In chapter two, you opened up a whole new world to me. Yeah, you might first of all pronounce the word that is the title for chapter two, because I'm not sure how I do pronounce it, and it's a Bulgarian word.
That's right. The word is gospodar, which is the word for master or lord.
And that master or lord is something that I think many people will understand and know is related to sadomasochistic encounters. And that's what we're dealing with in this chapter. And you don't spare us any blushes here. It's very explicit in its description of what goes on.
Well, you know, I did want to write this experience explicitly, and there are a couple of chapters in the book that are quite explicit. You know, what interested me was not explicitness in and of itself. I mean, you know, in the modern age with access to the internet, we all, you know, have access to more explicitness than we could ever want. But, you know, I think literature in representing explicitness can do something really important in the culture right now, because so much of the explicitness that we see on the internet, et cetera, you know, there are lots of bodies, but it seems to me that there's a real dearth of what I think of as embodiedness, which is the sense of a body filled with consciousness. You know, I mean, often when you look at, you know, explicit material pornography on the internet, you have the sense that these people have been reduced to objects. Well, literature is the best technology we have for the communication of consciousness. And so to write explicitness, you know, in a kind of literary style that foregrounds inwardness and consciousness, that felt to me like a way of reclaiming the body for consciousness.
You said it, or I read about you referring to the nature of the explicit sex, not as much of it in the first book, but quite more of it here in the second book. You said you wanted it to be 100% pornographic and 100% high art. I think that's the correct quote. Can those two things coexist?
Oh, absolutely they can. You know, this prejudice in especially English language literature and art against representing sex is just utterly bizarre to me. I mean, of course, this central, deeply important, very rich, you know, territory of human life, of course art can represent it. And I think, you know, art has something very important to bring to the representation of sex and to how we understand, you know, sex as that dense, rich act of human communication. I think it is.
There's another chapter in the book which gives the book its title, cleanness. It's a very loaded word, I think, in terms of what you're discussing here. What does that tell us about the nature of what you're trying to open our minds up to in the book?
Well, you know, I mean, I think so much of what we're taught about ourselves, about our relationship to our bodies, to our sexuality, to one another, you know, we're taught using this imagery of cleanness and filth. You know, I wanted to try to break down that dichotomy. You know, we're told so often, you know, that sort of we should strive to be clean, we should repress a desire for filth. I wanted to try to explore in this book what it might mean to find or to seek a model for life that wouldn't require that kind of repression, but that would instead try to accommodate what I think is a central contradiction of human life, which is that there's part of us that longs desperately to be clean and another part that longs to bathe in filth. What would it mean to try to create a life that could honor both of those desires without trying to demonize one of them? And could also, I would say, break down that dichotomy and show how actually in cleanness we find filth, in filth we find cleanness.
Was there something about the city of Sofia and perhaps the country of Bulgaria and its situation in the early 21st century? I believe it may have echoed your own experiences in late 20th century Kentucky growing up and coming out as a gay man.
Well, you know, that was the biggest surprise for me when I moved to Sofia in 2009. You know, on one hand, it felt like the continuation of a process. Basically, my whole life, I have been running away from the Kentucky of the early 90s, which was a desperately dangerous place to be a gay kid. And I found in Bulgaria, much to my surprise, that I was it was a place where I found I was forced to return to my childhood, to think about my childhood. And in large part, I think that had to do with my relationships with my students. You know, I was the only openly gay person in my school community. And that meant that kids who knew that they were lesbian or gay came to talk to me. And as they told me their stories for all the differences between Bulgaria in the 20-teens and Kentucky in the early 90s, it felt to me like they were telling me my own story, that they had grown up as I had in a place that taught them a single lesson about their lives, which was that their lives lacked dignity and their lives lacked value. And so, you know, being in a place like that, it was a very powerful experience for me that sort of sent me back to this past I had been running from.
You tell a story at one point later on in the book, the narrator and a friend of his head off to Bologna, in fact, and you tell the story of the Frog King. Maybe you'd give us the background of it. It's in and around New Year's Eve in Bologna, I believe. This is an important tradition. Maybe you'd give us a sense of that tradition and why it was important for you to include it in the book.
Well, so the central section of the book tells a love story, and it's a relationship, an experience of love that is revolutionary for the narrator, a kind of love he had never imagined would be possible for him. And yes, over a winter break, they take a budget trip together to Bologna, and they're there for New Year's. And in Bologna, as a New Year's celebration, they burn a large sculpture in the middle of the city as a kind of representation of cleaning away the old year and making space for the new year. And the year that the narrator and his partner are spend in Bologna, that statue, which has been made by a local artist, is of a frog king. And so that kind of bizarre, beautiful, funny image is at the heart of that chapter.
All right, that's Garth Greenwell. I believe, by the way, Garth, just before I let you go, there had been plans for you to travel to the United Kingdom and Ireland was possibly on your itinerary, but sadly that is not happening because of what's happening all around the world at the moment in terms of lockdown. So I do hope you can make your way to these shores before too long. And thanks for speaking with us this evening.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Garth Greenwell there speaking about his book Cleanless, which is published by Picador. And so into the final half hour of Friday night's programme, that last half hour before the weekend. And yes, it is the weekend and it's a bank holiday weekend, in case you hadn't noticed that. It's like that at the moment, isn't it? Time for album reviews. Three artists with one thing in common. They all go under pseudonyms for their various musical projects. First up, Brian Cristinizio, the man behind the musical moniker BC Camplight. His latest album is called Shortly After Takeoff. Cover 2 is the new album from Jonas Policewoman, also known as Joan Wasser. She pays tribute to some of her favourite artists and tunes that have influenced her throughout her career. And finally, Ghost Poet, the musical identity of the British singer, songwriter, musician and two-time Mercury Prize nominee, Obaro Ejimiwe. His current album, out today, is called I Grow Tired But Dare Not Fall Asleep. Let's start with BC Camplight. The album, Shortly After Takeoff, and from that album this is a track called Born to Cruise. Born to Cruise from the album Shortly After Takeoff from BC Camplight, one of three that's up for review. And Nadine O'Regan and Eamon Sweeney are our two reviewers this evening. Who are we talking about, Eamon, when we speak about BC Camplight?
BC Camplight is Brian Cristinizio, who is an American with Italian heritage who currently resides in Manchester. He was formerly a live member of the War on Drugs, and this is his fifth album. Whether he kind of will become as big as his erstwhile bandmate, Father John Misty, who remains to be seen. He's a fascinating figure, gone through a lot of darkness in recent times, and it's been even deported from England, but was able to get back in by claiming Italian citizenship. Of course, then that might change now, but the UK not being a member of an EU member state.
All right. Eamon has touched on this idea of the darkness that I think is part of this album, Nadine. But in the midst of the song we just listened to, Born to Cruise, there's a line, there's several of them, but this one jumped out at me. Nobody tells me how awesome I am. How firmly is his tongue planted in his cheek, or is it not planted in his cheek at all?
Oh, I think it's almost like a merry-go-round of different associations, some very positive, some very negative. I mean, he does say that the album reflects on his state of mental health and his sense of well-being, and certainly he goes from great highs to great lows, often within the space of about 30 seconds on the same song. I mean, there are moments of kind of wry reflection here, and then there are a lot of really specific lyrics that do kind of stick out at you, like when he's talking about how they got a delivery, a knock at the door, and he's like, oh, maybe it's the vegetable peeler we ordered, you know, and you find yourself listening to this going, oh my God. And there's another line where he starts actually the album saying, this afternoon I thought about book fast and space, and then he adds, and danced around my kitchen to Ace of Base. So, you know, there is humour threaded through this, but make no mistake, there's a lot of darkness as well.
And this is the final album in his Manchester trilogy. Did the previous two albums, Eamon, did they have that similar type of darkness, or is this a totally different take on the experiences he's been going through?
If anything, they were darker. What he's really done with this album is, on that track that we just heard, this real kind of pop heart that belies all that kind of darkness and the gallows humour that Nadine was just talking about. How to Deportation Blues, he was very, very dark and specifically addressing that. And even though he's addressing his mental health issues, losing his father and alcoholism, there's a lot of kind of a gallows humour that wasn't there in the first two albums of the trilogy.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the death of his father there, but also his alcoholism, and that's very much to the fore in this song, I Only Drink When I'm Drunk. After rabbits or Mancanians, baby, I'm in a hibernation. There you go. There's your book fast and your space for you, BC Camplight, and I Only Drink When I'm Drunk from the album Shortly After Takeoff. Does the stand-up routine work for you, Nadine? Does it pack enough of a punch?
Well, in the second song, he actually does have that kind of straight-ahead stand-up routine with canned audience laughter. And, you know, fundamentally, I found that a difficult aspect of the album, I probably prefer my albums to be a little bit more straight ahead in terms of their sense of direction. You know, he's breaking off to do these offbeat monologues, or he's changing things up genre-wise very, very fast. So sometimes he comes across a good hook, but he'll never hang on to it. He'll just move quickly to something else. And it can be a little bit disorientating, to be honest. Like, I found this album, you know, relatively easy to admire because I could hear that there was good artistry on it, and certainly the lyrics are particularly strong. But in terms of hooks, like, we all love a repeated hook. We love a great refrain. We love a great bridge. And I found it aggravating after a while that I wasn't getting that.
All right. Admiration and aggravation all in the one go. How does that translate into stars?
For me, I would go with 3 stars.
3 from you, Nadine. What are you saying, Eamon?
I would go 4 stars. Well, kind of, I can see Nadine's point. I actually like the dark, twisted pop kind of thing. I didn't find it aggravating at all. And maybe this album could tip him towards something like John Grant territory that took oodles of albums before anybody paid that much attention to him. So a strong four from me.
A four from you. That's a BC Camplight shortly after Takeoff, our first album this evening. Let's move on to album number two. Joan Wasser, also known as Jonas Policewoman, releasing an album of cover versions. It's called Cover 2. In it, she gives us her versions of classics from a diverse range of artists, including Prince, Blur, Neil Young and Talk Talk. It's called Cover 2 because she did this back in 2009, I believe, in an album called Cover. Nadine, how long have you got to answer this one? Are cover albums a good idea?
Do you know what, right? They're usually a money-making exercise, let's be honest about it. They usually come out around Christmas and they're usually themed. So, you know, they're a good commercial proposition. There's no two ways about that. And we all know that indie artists who cover big artists' songs can often make amends by showing us a different type of interpretation of it. That's not what I'm saying that she's necessarily doing here, but it has been done many times and often, and she has tackled really big artists on this album. You know, she's taken songs like Kiss from Prince. She's going for Talk Talk with Life's What You Make It, Blur, Out of Time, Michael McDonald, I keep forgetting. There are a lot of really big hits on this record.
And I think, Eamon, I fear that you may have made your mind up about this album even before you put the CD into the player, because of the opening track, even without hearing it, you were already against this album, the opening track being Kiss from Prince.
The opening track, Kiss by Prince, is probably one of my most detested songs of all time. I just think it's overplayed, overrated, horribly naff, just full of cliches. And then when Prince screams at the end, I just stop. I've heard it too much. But to her credit, after a few listens, once I got past my horror of it being Kiss, I really appreciate what she's doing. And it actually serves as a very good opening track for the album, which essentially is predominantly similar to the cover album in 2009. She tackles songs by male artists, predominantly male artists, turns them completely on their head and does her own thing with it, and kind of reinvents it and completely pares it down, so you don't have that horrible naff screaming from the artist formerly known as Prince at the end. And I got to really like it, but it took me a while, Sean. It took a few listens to get over that.
I heard your whoop of exasperation as Eamon's mention of the song, the Prince song, not being worth listening to. So, but I'm not going to play that cover version because I need to get beyond that conversation. I think you both mentioned Under Control and The Strokes. This one, did it work for you, Nadine?
Well, to an extent. I preferred the ones where she kept fairly firmly to the actual melody of the original song. What I really get annoyed by is indie artists who think that they're doing something cool when they take a really great punchy pop song or pop indie song and then essentially reduce it, make it sound dreary, use two instruments where the original band or artist had used 1,000, and then they turn around and go, well, now that's brilliant, isn't this? And it's just snobbery to me. So fundamentally, The Strokes, yeah, it was like the Blur song, actually, Out of Time, was where I thought she succeeded best. But The Strokes was certainly an interesting interpretation.
Well, listen, since you said Out of Time and the Blur song is the one that you like best, why don't I grant you that?
To open up your mind and watch the world spinning gently out of time.
Out of Time, Jonas Policewoman's version of the Blur song. And that, Nadine, you liked it. And Eamon, that was one of your highlights as well. Why did that song work so well for you, Eamon?
I love the original as part of it, but also it sounds nothing like Blur. It does what Joan Wasser always does and does so well as a vocalist and as a piano player. And the way she just kind of strips that back and taps into a different vein of the melancholy and the beauty of that song. It's a beautiful song. And also, it's also a point in the album where there's a real gear change for me. The last four tracks, I think, are absolutely brilliant. Her version of On the Beach by Neil Young is amazing. And that's, I think, when the album really comes into its own towards the end.
Right.
That and On the Beach. And indeed, actually, even I'd fly a flag for her version of the Strokes song as well, I think is really good.
Stars from you, Eamon.
I would go 3. Might have been a better EP or a mini album rather than a full album, but 3.
And I think you might be not even as generous as that on this Friday evening, Nadine.
Yeah, it's a mixed bag for me. And look, she's undoubtedly really, really talented. And I was very happy to listen to her other albums of her own original material. But on this one, it's very mixed, so I'd go 2.5.
All right, 2.5 from Nadine. Let's move on then to Ghost Poet. I grew tired, but I dare not fall asleep. We all feel that a little bit at the moment. Let's listen to that title track.
And I grow tired, but then I fall asleep. Who knows why we'll away if I fall too deep. Call it a mission, call it an interfere. But I am awake, I am awake. I swear in my dreams.
I grow tired, but I dare not fall asleep. A title track there from new album from Ghost Poet. This is his 5th album, I think, if I'm right, Nadine. He's achieved quite a bit in a short enough space of time over 4 albums before this one.
Yeah, nominated twice, I believe, for the Mercury. And, you know, when he came out with a bang. You know, he was someone who's been working with Massive Attack and very highly praised from an early point. And certainly you can hear it immediately. That tone is so interesting, like straight away, you know, 2 bars in. It reminds me a lot of sort of that tricky era, you know, back in 1990s trip-hop, Portishead, all that kind of minimalist, moody, atmospheric trip-hop that we actually, like, was a genuine big commercial thing for a period, but hasn't really re-emerged recently.
How political are the songs on this album, Eamon?
Very political, as in it will explicitly, he uses the phrase on my favourite track, Nowhere to Hide Now, about Project Fear repeatedly. And Project Fear was, even though I know the world has moved on dramatically since then, but the Scottish independence referendum of 2014 and the 2016 UK referendum on EU membership, that we politely call Brexit. And he references the Windrush generation, who, of course, you know, the scandal that came out during the Theresa May administration about the kind of the illegal detention of immigrants. And as a man of, with his, as he kind of says, his heritage, he says he is someone who was raised somewhere between London, Coventry, Nigeria, and the Dominican Republic. And he brings all that to the fore, and I think the clue is in his alias. He is a poet. He reminds me a lot of John Cooper Clarke, with a much more political edge, that kind of politics, the immigrant politics of, say, someone like, I suppose, the obvious reference points of Massive Attack and Tricky. Yeah. And he does it ever so well. I think he's really fantastic.
Yeah, he also, in the track Rats in a Sack, he uses the phrase out means out, again, a direct reference to Brexit.
Yes.
And Nadine, social lacerations, he's no prizes for guessing that he's having a go at social media there. Do the music and the message match up? You know, is it still a good listen, even though you might be getting a big political lecture in the process?
Yeah, because I don't think it's that obvious. It's not. It is atmospheric in the sense that, like, he'll say something like, "Things are getting complex. We better get our hard hats ready." And if you listen to that as sort of a throwaway line, you'll get a sense of foreboding, but you won't necessarily point it towards anyone paying until you start to sort of put it together as a tapestry. Like, personally, you know, for me, I actually love the sound. I've loved the sound over the course of his many albums, but I do worry that he hasn't moved on very much. There's not a lot of light on this album. Now, you could argue that we don't live in times that are very optimistic, but at the same time, I suppose part of me does want to feel that there's a sort of a leavening of the atmosphere at points, so that you can maybe just have a little bit more of a wider palette.
Fire and Judgment and Stars from you, Eamon, first of all.
I honestly think this is one of the best records I've heard this year, and I would go 4.5. I think it's absolutely fantastic and a soundtrack to anxious times.
All right. And from you, Nadine?
I really liked it. I would go with 3.5.
All right, that's it. 3.5, 3 albums this evening, shortly after Takeoff from BC Camplight, I Grow Tired But Dare Not Fall Asleep from Ghost Poet, and Cover 2 from Joan as Policewoman, Nadine O'Regan and Eamon Sweeney doing that for us this evening. But just before we finish up, Eamon, Damon Albarn of Blur, we've been speaking about him earlier on, Flea of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, have been amongst the many high-profile musicians paying tribute over the course of the day to the legendary drummer Tony Allen, whose death was announced announced yesterday. He's been described by Brian Eno as perhaps the greatest drummer who ever lived and one of the founders of Afrobeat with his long-term collaborator Fela Kuti. You actually saw him, I think, play alongside Fela Kuti at one stage, Eamon.
Oh, not quite. I'm not quite that lucky. I wish. I did see him play alongside Damon Albarn, Paul Simonon from The Clash, and Simon Tong of the Verve in a very small show in Hackney. And also in Vicar Street, he was part of an all-star lineup, again including Damon Albarn in Vicar Street called Rocket Juice and the Moon. That included Theo Parrish. And Flea for the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And I think the best quote out of in the tributes today that's been mentioned of him, describing his drumming style as like an octopus. And that's exactly what I got from, watching him. And there's a fantastic posthumous record now that he made, Rejoice, that only came out last March. That I would recommend to listeners to check him out of recent stuff.
That's Eamon Sweeney there speaking to us about the death of Tony Allan, and let's have a little listen to Lady from Fela Kuti and Africa.
Lady, I want to.
And just a little flavour there of Lady from Fela Kuti, and that to remember Tony Allan, the drummer, whose death was announced yesterday. And that is it from us for this week. But we will be with you, special programme for you on this coming bank holiday Monday. We'll be looking back at two programmes we shared with you earlier in the year, What Makes a Music Track Become Iconic, and we'll be revisiting our Star Wars special. Really good fun on both of those nights, so hope you can join me for the highlights of those two programmes on Monday evening here on RT Radio 1. But in the meantime, do have a great weekend, do stay safe, and keep the chin up. You know, we will get there eventually. Look after each other and look after yourself. The two things run hand in hand. That's it for this evening. Liam Murphy, Paula Shields researched. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Kieran Dunn was on sound. And tonight's programme produced by Olin McGann. Have a great weekend. Talk to you Monday.